Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
Right, and to give you the operational bottom line up front for today, we are tracking high-stakes friction over the U.S.-Iran ceasefire and maritime access. In Europe, we are seeing Russia combine hypersonic kinetic strikes with AI-driven cognitive warfare. And in the Indo-Pacific, the PLA is aggressively expanding its maritime and cyber capabilities to threaten regional trade arteries, specifically targeting Australia.
That is a lot of ground to cover. But with that official disclaimer out of the way, I want to officially welcome you to today's deep dive. Imagine looking at a military map where every single piece of data might be a complete mirage.
Yeah, it's a pretty unsettling thought.
Right. Like a world where a freshly signed peace treaty over a major shipping lane secretly contains the blueprints for a blockade. Or where this, you know, high-definition video of a triumphant battlefield victory was actually just generated by a computer an hour ago.
It's wild. It really is. It is a dizzying time to be tracking global intelligence because the traditional rules of engagement are just being rewritten in real time.
Which is exactly why we're diving into a massive stack of open source intelligence today. We've got these recent June 2026 reports from the Institute for the Study of War detailing some rapidly developing situations with Iran and Russia.
And we are pairing that with a really comprehensive Lowy Institute analysis on the Chinese military's expanding reach.
Exactly. The mission for this deep dive is to unpack these distinct global theaters. We want to understand how the actual mechanics of modern power, deterrence, and warfare are shifting right in front of us.
But before we get into the weeds, it's vital to explicitly state for you, our listener, that these sources deal with highly charged political and military developments.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're talking about actions by the U.S. administration, Israel, Iran, Russia, and Ukraine. And our job here is strictly analytical. We're not taking sides or endorsing any political viewpoints at all. We are just impartially analyzing the factual content presented in the sources.
Just the facts and the strategic implications. Okay, so let's unpack this. We're moving from a really fragile diplomatic deal in the Middle East to the grim reality of AI-driven warfare in Ukraine, and then finally looking at China.
Right.
Let's start with this monumental June 14th agreement between the U.S. and Iran. Brokered by U.S. President Donald Trump, it is slated to be signed in Geneva on June 19th.
Yeah, and on the surface, it sounds like a massive breakthrough, right? It calls for a ceasefire on all fronts, lifting the U.S. naval blockade on Iranian ports, and opening the Strait of Hormuz.
Sounds great on paper, but what's the catch here?
The catch is that the friction begins the second you look at the fine print, specifically how the two sides are defining the word open.
Oh, of course. It's always about the definitions.
Exactly. The U.S. expects the strait to be open and toll-free for the long term. That aligns with Western doctrines where, you know, unrestricted maritime trade is just a cornerstone of global commerce.
But Iranian media and officials are signaling something completely different, aren't they?
Very different. They intend to pause fees for only 60 days, and then they plan to resume charging what they call service fees under a joint Omani-Iranian management system.
See, that is, I mean, it's like signing a lease on a house, right?
Yeah.
You sign the paperwork, you think you have an agreement, but the landlord and the tenant have fundamentally different understandings of who actually holds the keys to the front door.
That's a really good way to put it.
Like, how can an agreement hold if the core definitions of an open strait are just entirely at odds?
Well, you have to look at how Iran views this. The Strait of Hormuz is not simply a toll booth for them to generate some extra cash. It is a core pillar of their strategic deterrence.
So it's about power, not just money.
Right. If they maintain management functions under the guise of collecting fees, they are asserting sovereignty. They retain the structural authority to restrict or close that waterway whenever they want.
And shipping companies are incredibly risk averse, right?
Oh, absolutely. Even with a signed agreement in Geneva, if Iran implies it controls the strait, and remember, they haven't cleared that. The naval mines they deployed earlier, commercial vessels might just refuse to transit.
Because the physical risk is still there?
Exactly. The underlying threat of violence is still dictating commerce.
Speaking of the threat of violence, the kinetic situation on the ground really threatens to blow up this Geneva deal before the ink is even dry.
Yeah, the Lebanon wrinkle is massive here.
The sources highlight this recent Israeli strike in Beirut, right in Hezbollah's stronghold. It killed a senior Radwan force commander named Ali Musa Dakduk.
And just for some context on him, the Radwan Force is Hezbollah's elite special operations unit. They're specifically trained to conduct cross-border infiltrations.
So he was a major player.
Yeah, Doc Duke wasn't just a mid-level guy. He had deep historical ties to the IRGC Quads Force, which is Iran's unconventional warfare branch.
Yeah,
he actively trained Iraqi militias back in the mid-2000s and was implicated in a 2007 attack that killed 5 U.S. soldiers.
So taking him out is a huge blow to Hezbollah's leadership, but I have to push back a bit on the sequence of events, the report's detail here.
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, they state that Iran initially prepared to retaliate for Doc Duke's death, right? But then they called it off after President Trump urged restraint.
Right, that's what the reporting indicates.
But how sustainable is that dynamic? Can a ceasefire agreement actually hold if Iran's proxies are still engaged in an active existential fight with Israel?
That right there points directly to the structural flaw in this whole setup. Iran is trying to thread an incredibly narrow needle.
How so?
They want to preserve Hezbollah, which is their most valuable proxy force in the region, while still reaping all the immense economic benefits of having the U.S. naval blockade lifted.
Trying to have their cake and eat it, too.
It's exactly. However, Hezbollah has accepted the ceasefire, but linked it to a maximalist demand, which is a complete IDF withdrawal from Lebanon.
A condition that Israel firmly rejects.
Flatly rejects. Israel says the IDF is going to maintain an indefinite presence in southern Lebanon's security zones.
So you have a peace deal contingent on the actions of Israel, a party that isn't even a direct signatory to the U.S.-Iran agreement in Geneva.
It creates a highly volatile loop. The diplomatic progress is completely handcuffed to tactical decisions happening on the ground.
It's just fascinating how Iran uses physical geography, like the narrow Strait of Hormuz, to project power. But, you know, physical geography is taking on a completely different meaning when we look at how Russia is fighting right now.
Oh, totally. A complete shift in tactics.
While Iran holds a physical choke point, Russia is actively trying to bypass maritime rules in one theater while simultaneously creating a cognitive choke point in another.
The maritime evasion stuff is a critical piece of modern economic warfare. The reports detail the UK making its first ever interception of a Russian Shadow Fleet oil tanker.
Right, the Smirtos.
Yeah, intercepted right in the English Channel.
Let's actually look at the mechanics of this, because I think it's wild. When we talk about a Shadow Fleet, we aren't just talking about ships sailing without their lights on at night, right?
No, it's way more complex than that.
Like, how do they actually move millions of barrels of oil past a global sanctions regime?
It's basically a high-stakes shell game. These vessels sail under what we call flags of convenience.
Okay, so registering the ship somewhere else.
Exactly. They register it in a country like Panama or Liberia to completely obscure the true Russian ownership.
Wow. Okay.
And then out on the water, they routinely turn off their automatic identification system, their AIS transponders, so they just vanish from commercial tracking screens.
Which sounds incredibly dangerous for other ships.
It is.
Yeah.
And they also conduct these highly dangerous ship-to-ship oil transfers in the middle of the ocean to mix the cargo. Plus, they forge insurance papers and manifests to make the crew look legitimate.
But when the Royal Navy physically boards a ship like the Smirtos in the Channel, that whole illusion shatters.
Oh yeah, you can't fake a cargo manifest to an armed boarding party.
Right. And the sources note that after the interception, several other Shadow Fleet tankers immediately changed course to avoid British waters. It's this global cat-and-mouse game over the economic lifeblood of their war.
Meanwhile, while Russia tries to hide its actions at sea, their kinetic attacks in Ukraine are highly visible and overwhelmingly brutal.
Yeah, we're seeing a severe escalation in the air campaign there. The ISW details massive Russian strikes on Ukraine between June 14th and 15th.
And this isn't just about the sheer volume of weapons. It's the sophistication of the munitions. They are utilizing Iskander ballistic missiles alongside hypersonic Zircon missiles.
And just to clarify the gravity of the Zircon for anyone listening who hasn't tracked its development, this is not your standard cruise missile.
No, not at all.
It's a hypersonic weapon, meaning it travels so incredibly fast and maneuvers at such unpredictable low altitudes that traditional radar and air defense systems simply cannot lock onto it before impact.
It condenses the reaction time to almost zero.
Right. And they paired these high-end missiles with hundreds of strike drones, deliberately targeting cultural sites, like the historic Kyiv-Pechersk Lavra.
The strategic goal there is twofold. Exhaust the Ukrainian air defense interceptors and shatter the psychological resilience of the civilian population.
And then the Russian Ministry of Defense turns around and hypocritically claims a Ukrainian Patriot interceptor missile was what actually struck the Lavra.
Even though independent investigations definitively proved it was a Russian Gerund 2 drone.
But here's where it gets really interesting to me. It's not just deflecting blame anymore. They are actively manufacturing an alternate reality using artificial intelligence.
Yeah, the cognitive warfare aspect detailed in these recent ISW reports is deeply alarming.
The Russian Ministry of Defense has been publishing high-quality, AI-generated deepfakes of Russian soldiers raising flags in contested areas, like Kostyantynivka and Kupiansk.
And they pass these off to the public as authentic tactical victories.
But I have to ask you, if Russia is supposedly this massive military superpower, why go through the trouble of generating deepfakes just to prove they took a single village?
It's a fair question.
Like, does this scream desperation or is it a calculated strategy?
It might look like desperation on the surface, but it is actually a highly calculated strategy of cognitive attrition.
Cognitive attrition. Okay, explain that.
So the battlefield is no longer just physical dirt and concrete, right? It's the minds of the Ukrainian population and Western policymakers.
Okay, I follow.
If you flood Telegram channels and social media feeds with photorealistic videos of Russian flags going up in every single town, you fabricate a sense of inevitable rapid collapse.
Ah, so you make the defense look completely futile, hoping the opposing side just gives up or pushes for a settlement before you actually have to fight for the territory.
Exactly, yeah. Because the reality on the ground in a place like Kostyantynivka is vastly different from what those deepfake videos show.
Far different. Ukrainian sources report only about like 100 to 150 Russian infiltrators are actually present there.
Right. It is a difficult, grinding tactical situation, sure, but it is not the sweeping, immediate victory those AI videos portray.
Mm.
Russia is trying to secure in the cognitive space what it's struggling to achieve quickly in the physical space.
That is just wild. So Russia is bogged down in this deceptive war of inches, fighting for individual towns and faking gains with AI. But if we pull back the lens and look at our final source, the Lowy Institute analysis, we see a nation playing a completely different, vastly longer game.
Yeah, the contrast in military doctrine here is striking.
China isn't fighting a grinding war of attrition. They are quietly restructuring global power projection.
The People's Liberation Army, the PLA, is modernizing at an unprecedented pace. They're shifting from a strategy of regional defense to a force capable of long-range global reach.
And the Lowy report focuses specifically on the PLA's threat to Australia. They list some formidable kinetic weapons, right? Like, yeah. China currently has DF-26 ballistic missiles stationed in the South China Sea that can hit northern Australia today.
And they are developing the newer DF-27, which could potentially cover the entire Australian continent.
But I have to push back here. Australia is roughly 4,000 miles away from the Chinese mainland.
Right, it's a massive distance.
If China's primary stated strategic focus is Taiwan, why are they investing so heavily in weapons that reach all the way down to Australia? It seems like a massive overextension of resources.
Well, it's not about physically invading the Australian mainland. It's about holding Australia's lifelines hostage to deter U.S. intervention anywhere in the Indo-Pacific.
Oh, so Australia is almost like leverage.
Precisely. The PLA's strategy targets the arteries of modern nations. Consider what sustains a modern island economy like Australia. 99% of its international trade by volume goes through ports, heavily transiting through the narrow choke points of the Indonesian archipelago.
So a PLA naval presence down there doesn't need to fire a single missile at Sydney.
Not at all. They just need to interdict trade, cause maritime insurance premiums to skyrocket, and effectively choke the economy.
And the digital arteries are even more vulnerable, aren't they?
Oh, incredibly vulnerable. Up to 95% of the world's international data travels through undersea fiber optic cables.
And their locations are pretty much public knowledge.
Exactly. So a deep water navy can physically tap or sever those connections, plunging a modern economy into darkness and financial chaos.
Which ties directly into the cyber component the Lowy report highlights, the PLA's new cyberspace force.
This is a huge piece of the puzzle.
We've seen reports of operations like Volt Typhoon, right? For anyone tracking cyber warfare, Volt Typhoon is this Chinese state-sponsored group known for living off the land.
Right, meaning they don't always inject obvious malware that standard antivirus software can easily catch.
Yeah, they use built-in network administration tools to quietly hide within critical infrastructure, totally evading detection.
And the implications of that capability are just chilling. They're infiltrating power grids, water supply networks, communication hubs. And they aren't doing it to cause immediate disruption.
They're just pre-positioning themselves.
Right. If a conflict over Taiwan erupts, they can instantly activate that access to paralyze logistics and public utilities across the region. It would severely complicate any allied military response.
The sources use a terrifying analogy for this. Pre-positioning cyber access in a nation's critical infrastructure is functionally identical to pre-positioning a stealth submarine right off their coast.
It's a dormant weapon lying in wait.
And China is building the conventional maritime forces to back up these asymmetric threats at just a staggering scale.
The sheer scale of the naval buildup is historically unprecedented. By 2035, projections show China will have 25 nuclear-powered attack submarines, or SSNs.
And unlike traditional diesel subs that have to surface frequently, these nuclear-powered vessels can stay submerged indefinitely, right?
Yes, and they can launch long-range cruise missiles. You combine that with the construction of massive aircraft carriers and an expanding amphibious assault force, and you have a military designed to permanently alter the global balance of power.
They are systematically dismantling the U.S. military primacy that regional allies have relied upon for decades.
Because even if they never launch a single DF-27 missile, simply possessing the capability to control the maritime and digital arteries creates immense structural pressure.
It pressures regional states to just capitulate to Beijing's demands.
It creates a reality where resistance becomes economically and logistically unviable before a war even starts.
So, what does this all mean for us when we look across these three distinct theaters, the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the Indo-Pacific, a singular theme really emerges from all this intelligence?
Yeah, it all ties together.
We are entering an era of what we might call choke point hegemony.
Choke point hegemony. I like that term. It is entirely about commanding the critical nodes of connection that the modern world absolutely relies on to function.
Right. Whether that means controlling the physical shipping lanes of the Strait of Hormuz to extract diplomatic leverage, or whether it's evading economic blockades with shadow fleets conducting dark transfers in the English Channel.
Or manipulating the cognitive space, the very perception of truth, by flooding the internet with AI deepfakes.
Or quietly mapping out undersea cables and pre-positioning cyber weapons in the Indo-Pacific. Power is now completely entangled with these physical and digital networks.
The capacity to disrupt, manipulate, or sever those networks is the ultimate form of modern leverage.
Right.
If you control the choke points, you control the battle space.
It is a massive shift in how the world operates. And I want to leave you, our listener, with a final thought to just mull over.
Always good to end with a big question.
We've spent a lot of time today talking about high-speed missiles, AI warfare, and global cyber forces. As nations build these deep water navies capable of striking anywhere on Earth, and digital malware that bypasses physical borders entirely, does physical geography even matter anymore?
That is the big question.
Are the vast oceans that historically acted as impenetrable defensive moats for continents like North America and Australia no longer barriers, but simply superhighways for next-generation threats?
It really forces a total recalculation of what national security actually means in the 21st century.
It really does. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. The geopolitical map might be messier than ever, but understanding the mechanisms behind it, the how and the why, is the first step to making sense of it all. Keep questioning the headlines, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.